Welcome to Life and Love in the Q, a podcast for the LGBTQIA2S+ community, those who support them, and those who just want to learn more.
Together we share the stories and the science of the space and grace to live life in full color.
I'm Jillian Abbey, proud lesbian and mother, Hay House author, queer blogger, and TikTok something or other.
And I'm Trisha Peterson. I'm an LGBTQ ally, proud mom of six, professor and researcher of identity and the social narratives that impact the way we live and love.
So open your mind, open your heart, and welcome to Life and Love in the Q.
Dr. Trisha, we have an interesting episode ahead of us today, one that I think is a really important conversation to have, one that may feel like a very heavy conversation for you and I both, and along with our Q Crew listeners, but I hope one that I think will bring comfort to people as well. And so the theme of our episode today is when the most loving thing is letting go.
Yeah, this one could be heavy.
Yeah, in both of our situations, you and I have both been in long-term marriages. You and I are both navigating through or have finished the divorce process. Even when the paperwork's finalized, there's still so much more to figuring out life after that.
Yeah.
Letting go just of identities that we used to carry or images, perceptions that people had of us in the past that have changed. And I think it's easy to feel bad about letting things go, but sometimes it is the most loving thing we can do.
Yeah. I was scrolling on Instagram a couple days ago and I found this quote from Jay Shetty that I love. And it says, "It isn't love if you become someone you hate for someone you love. It's self-sabotage." I've thought a lot about that in terms of this conversation, because I think a lot of times we get into relationships and they can be really well-meaning and good relationships, but I think that we do start to mask and hide and try to fit into one another's lives. And again, the social narrative, at least in my world, the social narrative really has people enmeshing with one another very quickly once they couple. And
yes.
So, you know, you might spend holidays at each other's house, or you pick up one another's interests.
Yeah, I think the enmeshment rate for lesbians is like 24 hours. Like it's we joke about U-hauling is a term in the women loving women community, because it's like you go on where's a lesbian's first date at U-Haul, because you are already moving in together and you're like, I've found my soulmate and we've lived 80 past lives together. But anyways, I digress, because not everyone listening is a lesbian. I'm sure you have much longer enmeshment periods.
Well, but that's the thing. I don't know. Like I was thinking about if you've got religion. Religion is you enmesh immediately. Again, in my religion, the narrative is the husband is the breadwinner and the wife is the nurturer. And so the moment you meet somebody, that you are automatically enmeshing with the way that the system tells you that you are supposed to do it. My daughter and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and she said she was in a young women's Sunday school meeting when she was about 15. And they were talking about women being stay-at-home moms, and it's the woman's responsibility to raise the kids and blah, blah, blah. And my daughter said, well, what happens when the couple gets a divorce and the woman needs to be able to provide for herself? And her Sunday school teacher looked at her and said, why would a woman ever get divorced? And my daughter was like, wait, that's the thing that you're worried about? But that's so true. Like, again, in our religion, it becomes so quick that you enmesh one another's stories that I don't think there's a lot of what we talked about in the last episode and in that bonus episode, where I don't think that there are those reevaluation periods when you've enmeshed yourself with a couple where you stop and you say, wait, are we still both happy? Are we actually following what we think that we're supposed to do? Or are we still developing across our lives as individualized people?
For me, that concept of supposed to, like I felt at a certain point in my life, like I had reached the top of supposed to mountain. I got the degree I was supposed to get. I got the job I was supposed to get. I met the guy I was supposed to meet and marry and fall in love with and have the two kids in the house. And I remember feeling so hollow and empty in that moment, because it's like I did all of the supposed to's and I still feel hollow. I don't know any other way to describe it, of like there was like a void or a hunger of this is not it. The supposed to's did not lead me to the purpose of our human experience of being here. I'm not living as a full human. What the hecking heck?
So when supposed to leaves you stagnant is maybe an important thing to consider. Have you hit the top of supposed to mountain, but now do you feel stagnant and hollow?
Right. Because it's like, well, where do you go from here? And I think that's why too, we don't, you know, to your daughter's point with her very wise and brave question to ask at a church event and as a 15-year-old. We don't talk a lot about letting go. Like sometimes that's not even an option on the table. Mm-mm. Because if you've already met the mold of this is what life is supposed to be like, it's very easy to talk yourself into or convince yourself that, well, this is just what life is. I hear a lot of people say all the time, like, well, marriage is just really hard. And I'm not saying that it's not. Anytime you're taking two personalities and you're putting them together and there is so much change, like you said in our other episodes about reevaluating regularly and, you know, and are you still on the same path and can you work through things together? Marriage is hard, yes, but we push that so heavily as a narrative also that sometimes we stay in bad marriages because we just go, well, it's just supposed to be this way. And we don't always give ourselves permission to even float the idea of letting go. Because in the short term, letting go almost always seems like a really bad idea. Like divorce, bad idea. Coming out, bad idea.
I've had this dream probably 4 times in the past couple of months where somebody is pushing me off of a cliff and I'm pawing at the gravel. I know, why would they be pushing me off the cliff?
You're so nice.
You're like pawing at the gravel to try to find, you know, your stable footing so that you don't actually fall. And I feel like that's exactly like when we come to a place in our lives where we know a change is needed, instead of allowing ourselves just to fall over the edge of the cliff, we just try to hold on to this loose gravel that is really just more painful. We're clawing at everybody around us. It's more painful for everybody, in my opinion.
Sure.
But we don't have a standard in our social norms for Shefali. I can't remember her last name. Dr. Shefali has a way that she phrases it and she calls it conscious recoupling. Mm. And I love that. But we don't talk about that, where it's okay to recouple. And that could be recoupling in the same couplage, but just totally reframing the relationship.
Right.
Or recoupling where we end the relationship, but we do it consciously.
Yeah.
And have still a good relationship with our partners.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but speaking of falling off of cliffs. So my sport of choice when I was a teenager is I was a springboard diver. And I even did the high dive for a little while, for a hot minute. And the scariest part of that is always right before you're about to jump. And even like when you're immediately off the board or off the platform, that those first few seconds in the air of, oh crap, there's no going back now, is terrifying. And then eventually it's like, okay, nope, my body knows what to do. This is what we do here. And then you break through that water and it's like, okay, we got there. We did it. Or sometimes you belly flop and it hurts and you're like, note to self, we're going to do that a little differently next time. But I was thinking about that in terms of any life changes, about how right at the beginning, it is scary because we don't always know exactly how it's going to go. And there's always just that surge of like, oh, should I have jumped off this board or this platform to begin with? Of life, not just in the diving scenario. But in the long term, if you're looking at the full view of everything that happens, like things can get better. And maybe that is why when we're looking at letting go being a loving thing, in the short term, I think it's hard to see it as loving. There's a lot of, when we make these big identity shifts, even if it's the best thing for us, if we think it's hurting other people, or if it is hurting, it may hurt other people. My ex-spouse was hurt by my decision to come out in the immediate short term. I don't know if we look enough at the long term, though. And can I heal? Can he heal? Can I start a new relationship? Can he start a new relationship? I don't know. If I look at my coming out as two separate roads of, I can stay in this relationship until death do us part and mask the fact that I'm queer for my entire life, or I can be honest with him and with myself and with the people around us now and let us move forward with our goals, agencies, and pathways from there. I think if we looked at it that way and you said, well, which one seems more loving? The one where it feels lying and deceitful, but at least you know that road that you're on, or saying, hey, this is going to be really hard right now, but at least we know we can grow from here. We do have the opportunity to grow. Which pathway looks more loving? What feels like love? And for me, the more loving thing felt like being honest and at least giving him the ability to make his own life decisions as well. This is who I am now, and I'm being honest with you. Finally.
Yeah, I think I'm still super new in a lot of my part of the journey. So like I've got all of the research on how disruptive and maladaptive and dysfunctional it can be to be in a masking and hiding situation, and how detrimental to our well-being it can be to not make choices and to leave ourselves in that uncertainty loop. So I have this is one of the areas that I think in my life has always been interesting, is so I know the science behind it, but then I also know how it has felt in my own heart. And sometimes it takes a while for my heart to catch up to what the science knows. So my heart and mind fight with each other a lot when it comes to this. But I feel like in my relationship, I know how much I was struggling trying to make sense of how different my family had gotten from the social narrative, and the constant level of distress that I felt trying to make sense of some of the things that were happening in our family. And I don't know if I've ever shared this quote before, but that the definition of trauma is too much too fast with too few resources. And in our family, that's kind of how I view it. And this is all my own perspective, but we just had so much coming at us. And for so many years, we just kept trying to get back on the path that the church had been trying to prescribe to us. The thought that came to my mind this morning as I was thinking about this episode was, my husband and I became parents very young, and then we were parents, and then we stayed parents for 30 years. And I love my children. And this is one of the things that I think is very hard for some people to understand. I love my children and I love being a mom, but I got to a point where I hated the maternal role so much. In order for me to hate the maternal role, I needed my husband to be able to change his paternal role. But he was also, I say this all the time, the men socialized as father have a narrative that is just as destructive. Or feminism impacts men as much as it does women, and social narratives impact men just as much as it does women. So I talk a lot about that maternal narrative, but the man has a similar narrative going down that is just as painful and destructive. But we just couldn't get out. And I felt like the resentment and the frustration and the anger had gotten so deep that the kindest thing I could do was to ask for a divorce. And I mean, I still, as a matter of fact, I said this to my kids on Christmas Day. I really, really struggled with Christmas Day, to be honest, because it looks like everybody's doing okay. And I felt very sad that I had to lose so much in order to put enough of a break in the system that people could start thriving on their own. It was a hard, my ex-husband tried really hard to host dinner, and he's been so kind. And I know he's hurting too. He's not having a party on his end. I know that. But we just, the most loving, we were hurting each other constantly with the things that we were saying and the things that we were doing. And again, there's no model that says, how do we step out of the narrative and create something new when we have 32 years of momentum behind us?
Yeah. And it's so hard too, because people around you, nobody is in your own relationship and understands the day to day. And I think we've painted divorce and separation as such a dirty word, as such a bad word, or something that we can't speak about, or even like, and I just have to mention this as an aside, how freaking brave and beautiful it is of you to even just mention just now that we can love being mothers and hate aspects of motherhood or hate that role, because I think there are so many people that feel that. And again, it's such a dirty topic that we're not allowed to talk about or feel that way, because suddenly we become bad people.
Yeah.
it is so hard because only we know the experience that we're going through, or only you knew what that relationship was like with your ex-husband. And so when we tell others that we're getting a divorce or making any other sort of big changes, we do get a lot of judgment from people. But oftentimes they don't, again, they're looking at the short term and they're going with the story that they've been told about what that means, and not understanding the gift that you just gave to yourself, to your ex-spouse, to your children, to put the brakes on.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know that my ex-husband feels that way at this point, but I think shortly after we separated, I saw on Facebook somebody post, and it was somebody that we go to church with, or we used to go to church with, and they posted something about divorce being the biggest act of selfishness that a person could do. And I totally know the story behind the two people that they were talking about in this post. But 42 people that I went to church with, or that I had gone to church with in the past, chimed in to agree that divorce is one of the most selfish things that a couple can do for themselves and for their children. And it's so destructive. But actually, the research doesn't show us that. The actual statistics on divorce don't agree with the fact that divorce is the most destructive thing that a couple can do. The most destructive thing that a couple can do to children's well-being is to stay in an unhappy marriage. So, but we have,
why doesn't that get publicized more? Because everyone can say, oh, at least 50% of US couples now are getting divorced. And then it's a broken home and the family system is falling apart. But really, maybe that's not the conversation. I mean, yeah, okay, that is a fact or a statistic or whatever. But really, going back to what you're saying, what makes a healthy family?
Yeah.
Divorce may be part of that.
Divorce might be. And going back to what we talked about in that bonus episode, here's the gig. Do you know anybody who's been divorced and then they've remarried each other?
My parents?
Yeah. I know five.
Yeah. No, my parents are not the only one, but they are one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we were selling our house, and my realtor actually said, just whatever you do, don't get remarried, because what a brain fuck that is for kids. And I was thinking, don't say that. Don't say that, because I don't know. I have no idea. And I'm not putting that out there. But again, if you're in momentum that you can't stop, for whatever reason, you can't stop the momentum, the most loving thing you can do is stop the car from going down the hill. Like, put on the brakes, do what you need to. But I don't think people realize how easy it is to fall into dysfunctional relationships anyway, whether we fall into codependency or we fall into people pleasing or we fall into enmeshment or we fall into just our family patterns. And we don't realize that our family patterns were quite as messed up as they are. So first of all, I don't think that people realize just how dysfunctional some of the marriages in this world are. Mm-hmm. And then again, it's okay to get to a point where you might make a decision. And then 6 months, a year later, you're like, oh, I kind of want to rebuild this thing with you, but different. Can we redo this different?
Yeah.
Can I date you again? Like, I don't know. That was a detour, but
no, but it's another option. I mean, when we're talking about, and again, we talked about in the bonus footage from last time, like one of the biggest fears about coming out is people say, well, what if that's not my truth either? What if I made a mistake? And, you know, in some case, not in all cases, but in some cases, relationships do bounce back. I want to like put a little asterisk and clarify. I can't really recall of anyone I've met so far who has come out and then said, oh, I'm actually not gay. Aside from my son, because he didn't know what gay meant. And so he told his friends he was gay because he didn't want to hang out with the girls on the playground. And I was like, oh, baby, no. So I have the first hetero child who's come out as gay. But anyways, total tangent there. But yeah, we have a lot of options. And I think there's no permanence. I don't know. There's just not a whole lot of, like, just because we make a decision doesn't mean like that is now the path you have to follow for life. Like, at what, if that were the case in life, how scary that the career you picked as your first career is the one you have to stay with your whole life, or that first person you ever dated is the one you have to stay with your entire life. Like, that's not how life works. We reevaluate, we make new choices. And for some people, maybe that choice is going back to the relationship they were in once they've had their time apart to reevaluate and reassess.
Yeah. And I will just say, so I have one friend and two clients. They were in hetero relationships. One of the partners in all three of the couplings questioned whether or not they were lesbian. They all three took between a 3 and a 6 month break for that person to reassess. And then actually in all three, and I'm not saying that this is the way it would always be, but it is funny that all three of them, they came back together with both partners recognizing that there was bisexual identification, but they decided to remain, all three of them decided to remain in their hetero passing relationships. All three of them are in committed relationships. They are all very happy, but they needed that process to understand that, that little bit of self-doubt. But it was, I think it's interesting in all three of those situations where they came back and the other, their partner also identified as bisexual.
Fascinating. It's like we're all on a spectrum or something with all sorts of different types of attraction and different ways of being.
Yeah. Wow. But they came back. It was that the most loving thing to do was to let go enough to explore that possibility. And again, if we go back to what we were saying before, there are no mistakes. I mean, you ate cheesecake, you might have gotten a sick belly, blah, 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 but you recover, you know. Then the next,
I'm over it. We're already on the next day and I'm going to do the same thing.
The next day you eat one bite less of cheesecake.
Holiday regrets. Yeah. I love that point that you mentioned that letting go is not always a letting go forever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is and sometimes it's not.
I have no idea what will happen with my ex-husband, but I will say that I probably have never felt more love and grace for him in my entire relationship with him than I have over the past 4 months. Wow. I needed 2 months to process a lot of grief, and I am processing grief like I have never processed grief in my entire life. And I actually want to say I've probably cried more tears over the past 6 months than I even knew my body could produce. So I'm not trying to paint a story of this is like the easiest journey I've been on. But at the end of the day, every single day, I come back to a place where my love for him and my just my level of gratitude and grace for him seems to be magnifying on a daily basis. Whereas a year ago, I mean, I read back on my journals from a year ago and making the decision and just recognizing we were in such a trauma loop. It just wasn't even funny. It really was just not even funny. And we just had nobody that could truly process what was happening with us. So there, I mean, to pretend that there's not hurt when you're in a trauma loop is just not even fair. You're overreactive. You say things that you don't mean, and you don't remember things that you say and do, because when you're reactive and that autopilot kicks in, you can say things to people that you truly don't remember you've said. So I don't know. To me, it feels like the most loving thing. It's also the most painful thing. Sometimes you have to hold, like I said about the one little words for the new year. Sometimes you have to hold both.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful thought to end on.
Yeah. All right.
All right, friend.
You have a good day.
You too. Thanks, listeners.
Thank you for listening to Life and Love in the Q. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like, subscribe, and share. And if you have questions, contact us at lifeandloveinthequeue@gmail.com. Until next time, Q Crew.